Well, we continue in the third class on this Dharma Nature essay of Dogen. And we left off at this quote from Master Matsu. Who says in this other translation, all living beings have for limitless kalpas or eons been abiding in Dharma Nature Samadhi. While in Dharma Nature Samadhi, they wear clothes, eat food, talk and respond to things. Making use of the six senses, all activity is Dharma Nature. It's because of not knowing how to return to the source that they follow names and seek forms from which confusing emotions and falsehood arise, thereby creating various kinds of karma. When within a single thought, one turns the light around and shines it back, then everything is sacred mind.
And whose translation is that?
That's
Cleary?
That's Chung Chien Bhikshu in Sun-Faced Buddha.
Wow.
It's on
we like it.
Page 64. Yeah, this is the teachings of Matsu. Dogen doesn't quote that whole section, but it's the third paragraph from the bottom. Matsu, Zen Master Daji of Jiangxi. Our translation says, no sentient beings have the need to come out of Dharma Nature Samadhi for innumerable eons. And it looks like the original doesn't imply so much that they don't have a need to, but they could, but it's more that they can't. They don't ever leave Dharma Nature Samadhi. They stay in Dharma Nature forever, wearing a robe or clothes, eating a meal and exchanging words. These activities are the six sense roots. Of the six sense roots are no other than Dharma Nature. And for those arriving today, we've talked about this term Dharma Nature is as opposed to Dharma. Dharmas are like phenomena or things or experiences, and Dharma Nature is like the true nature of phenomena, things, or experiences. And their true nature is that they are empty of being phenomena or things. And so that's the topic of this essay, is the true nature of things. And in Matsu, one of the old Chinese Zen ancestors, says this extraordinary realization of Dharma Nature Samadhi, absorption in the reality of the emptiness of all things, that all beings have never left this. We are always in it from the beginning. That's the kind of trademark of the Zen style, is that you can't escape Buddha's mind, even though you might not know it. But this leaves some problems for us, right? Because let's say, well, yeah, so, but what about my suffering? What to do? How to practice with this? So this book, Sun-Faced Buddha, has some nice points in the in the introduction. He talks about the style of the Southern school, and this early Zen is always emphasizing non-duality and being Buddha. But we have to remember the context, the translator says. And wondering why there's never any, like, you know, practical methods of you know, or what to do about, like, my issues. It's just realize the way, right? In this early Zen school. And the translator says, in looking for possible reasons for the apparent lack of expedient means in the records of the teachings of these early Zen ancestors, it might be useful to remind ourselves of the audience to whom the teaching was directed. As the records make it clear, most of the teachings were received by monks who were familiar with the basic Buddhist practices and ideally already had good command of the doctrinal teachings of the Buddha. So this is the context, right? People had been studying the sutras, how, you know, the basic practices of Buddha Dharma for a long time already, and they were living in this rigorous practice environment where they were making great effort to practice. And in that context, they were hearing. And by the way, there's nothing to get here and nothing to do and everything's perfect from the start. We are not in a position to know the exact details of the various instructions that were given to students due to the very limited material at our disposal, most of which was not written by these ancestors themselves, and was also edited a number of times. In other words, this is like this refined, edited version that comes to us of these Zen teachings, and they maybe gave a lot of practical instructions about, like, the posture and the breath and so on, but these don't get recorded in these old records. And compassion practices and ethical practices and all of these things are maybe, that's in their daily life, you know, they're talking about this. It seems that the basic practices of making offerings to Buddhas, studying the precepts and meditation were all too familiar to be regarded as something that was necessary to be recorded. So it's kind of like, well, we don't need to talk about that because we've already been doing it for years. So it brings up the question of, like, in our case, is it appropriate to talk this way? But when I look around, I see here's a bunch of people who've been practicing Zen for years. Some for a shorter time, some for a longer time. And we've heard a lot. Everybody in this room has heard about compassion practices and precepts and meditation. Yeah, exactly.
That's a good. Off the compassion boat.
So maybe okay. But then, you know, to go downtown and tell people, hey, you know, Zen is just like being yourself. So just don't try to do anything. People might be like, sure, okay. I'm already doing that. So it does depend on context. And he quotes here the Dharma grandson of Matsu, Gweishan. Matsu's student, Baijiang, was the teacher of Gweishan. And one time the monk asked Gweishan, does a person who had sudden awakening still need to continue with cultivation? It's also reminiscent of Nettie's talk the other day.
Yeah,
the fox koan. And maybe that was a common question they had in these early days of Zen, when they're so emphasizing the sudden realization. So Gweishan said, if one has true awakening and realizes the fundamental, then at that time that person knows for herself that cultivation and non-cultivation are just dualistic opposites. In other words, the very idea of cultivating some practice is just a conceptual idea in relation to non-cultivation. You know, he just breaks down the question immediately into, what is cultivation anyway? But however, if within a single thought one awakens to one's own reality, there are still certain habitual tendencies that have been accumulated over numerous kalpas which cannot be purified in a single instant. That person should certainly be taught how to gradually remove their karmic tendencies and mental habits. This is cultivation. So, there's a sudden recognition of non-dual reality, but this doesn't like wipe out all the past karmic tendencies. He still doesn't say what the cultivation is, but sometimes we might say, well, just realize that again and again, you know, remember this again and again would be one way to look at it, as well as remembering the more conventional practices of avoiding all harm and doing all good and so on. But I think I hear that Dogen, for example, thousands of pages over and over again keeps pointing us back to this truth all through this essay too, that there's nothing to realize outside of this mind here and now. But we forget that. Partly that's our karmic tendencies accumulated since beginningless time, is that like they're stronger than our momentary recognition. Sometimes we have that recognition. Oh yeah, it's so clear, it's so obvious. How could I ever hold on to those problems again? And in the moment we sometimes might feel this way. On a good day. but then it doesn't last, right? So then again, we have to remember, we have to, you know, come back to this truth until it seeps into the marrow of our bones.
Conditioning has been going on for kalpas.
Yeah, so we have to recondition ourselves for some more kalpas. to recondition ourselves to this immediate present that's complete. Another classic teaching of Matsu's, maybe most well-known teachings, are mind itself is Buddha. That was Matsu. And ordinary mind is the way. Also Matsu. Here he talks about, I hear this is the same instruction as all beings have always been in this Dharma nature, samadhi, wearing their clothes and eating their food. They've never left this suchness. But we just have to recognize this. So here, Matsu says, the way needs no cultivation, no practice. Just do not defile. You might say, is that a cultivation, not defiling? Not exactly like, it's not exactly doing something. It's more like not doing something, right? The way needs no cultivation. You don't need to do anything. Just don't defile. What is defilement? When with a mind of birth and death, one acts in a contrived way, then everything is defilement. If one wants to know the way directly, ordinary mind is the way. What's meant by ordinary mind? No activity, no right or wrong, no grasping or rejecting, neither impermanent nor permanent, without worldly or holy. The sutra, this is the Vimalakirti Sutra, says, neither the practice of ordinary people nor the practice of sages, that's the bodhisattva's practice. Mm-hmm. So this ordinary mind is not the mind of ordinary people, but it's not the mind of sages either. This is the kind of ordinary with a capital O. A capital but unholy O. Just like now, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, responding to situations and dealing with people as they come, everything is the way. So, same as everybody's always in this Dharma nature, samadhi. And the practice is just don't defile it by our dualistic thought.
It's kind of like letting the appropriate response arise.
Yeah. Letting it arise without the self creating it. Yeah. And Matsu says later in this other long talk of Matsu's on page 67, he quotes again the Vimalakirti Sutra that says, not obliterating the conditioned, not dwelling in the unconditioned. So this is we've talked about in the previous weeks, that Dogen makes this point and will continue to make this point, that there's people often think this dwelling in the Dharma nature, samadhi, is like nothing can happen there. Almost like you have to obliterate conditions. And here the sutra is saying it's not obliterating the conditioned phenomena. It's not dwelling in the unconditioned. And then Matsu says, the conditioned is the function of the unconditioned. The unconditioned is the essence of the conditioned. So, can you get a sense of that? So here, conditioned and unconditioned, we could say, in our case of this essay, is like, the conditioned is dharmas, the conditioned phenomena and things that arise and cease in the world, and the unconditioned is dharmata, or the nature of things, that doesn't come and go, and is the actual nature of the conditioned dharmas. Therefore, the conditioned, the dharmas, are the function of the unconditioned dharmata. In other words, dharmata, or suchness, functions as the phenomenal world, Matsu says, and the unconditioned is the essence of the conditioned. So the dharmata is the essence of the dharmas. And then he says, the mind can be spoken of in terms of its two aspects. Again, we could call it dharmas and dharmata, or things and the nature of things. But he calls it here birth and death and suchness. The mind as suchness is like a clear mirror which can reflect images. The mirror is this mind of suchness. The images are the dharmas. If the mind grasps at dharmas, then it gets involved in external causes and conditions, which is the meaning of birth and death. If the mind does not grasp at dharmas, that is suchness. So, yeah, grasp is the basic thing. We think of, there's gross grasping of like, you give me it, it's mine. And then there's just like perceiving a world of phenomena is a kind of subtle version of grasping. I'm here and there's all these things. And basically, even if we're like pretty cool with them, the setup is such that like sooner or later, those things are going to trigger me. So, this is maybe, we could say, a tall order to come to see that things aren't separate from mind. As the tradition has implied, it was a tall order. This is realizing Buddhahood. But then as the Zen ancestors imply, you can't ever escape it, this suchness, this non-duality we're actually living in all the time. That's the emphasis of Matsu. And the so-called sudden school. It's not exactly, maybe sudden isn't even quite the right word. It's not like something suddenly happens. Maybe more like the imminent school. It's like, it's already so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's what, it's so sudden that it's already the case.
Yes. That's contrasted with that one has to
gradually,
because this isn't it.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're on the path to it.
Yep.
This isn't it.
Yep, right. Mm-hmm.
Even though there is a path and developmental aspect to the sudden school as well.
Yes, there's both sides, as Guishan said. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But we're not going anywhere.
Yeah, you could say it like that.
Yeah, and if you're in the moment, you are in suchness. I mean, that is suchness.
That's coming up here, actually. Okay. The here and now moment part. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is also Dogen's non-duality of practice and realization. Mm-hmm. It's the practice and verification of Buddha's mind. It's this verification is not like after like a long time of practice, then it's verified. It's more like the moment of practice is the moment of verification.
Would you say that if we remember the nature of things while we're engaging with things, then we are in this sudden, imminent moment?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Remembering the nature of things at the same time.
Yeah.
Like the chair is the chair, but I also am very aware of that it's the forest and it's oxygen and it all break down and turn into dirt sometime.
And you know, and that's still like a conceptual story. So I think it's not so much like we're like analyzing things in this way of breaking them down. But maybe if it, we can do the analysis also, and then to the point where we become more and more convinced that the chair is not really the chair, especially that, you know, not. It depends on the tree and the oxygen and all, but particularly it depends on our conceptual imputation of naming and conceptualizing it as a chair.
And sitting in it.
Sitting in it?
And sitting in it, yeah, as a chair.
There's it depends chair. On that. You know, because we conceptualize it, we don't even think twice before we sit in it. We just know that that's for sitting and we sit in it. We take it for granted instead of like, what is that thing?
Yeah.
You're like more like so. I had this remembering. I think we can say remembering, and maybe at the deepest level, it's like a remembering that's like not even a conceptual remembering, but more like where this is where you could say the union of the two truths. We're seeing the chair, and we're at the same simultaneously seeing that it's not a chair, and. But, you know, that sounds kind of abstract until we... So it takes some conceptual
framing
and like, investigation to... And again, over and over, I think, because we're going to... As soon as we stop the investigation, we look at the chair, and it's a chair again. I mean, we see it as a chair. This also reminds me of a point in my studies in Nepal this winter, studying these middle way teachings. One point that was particularly emphasized over and over, that's kind of a subtle point, and there's some debate about this, but we say, some people say, we're looking at the chair, and the emptiness of the chair is the emptiness of the inherent existence of the chair. Right? It's like that the chair has some abiding like essence or inherent existence in itself, and that's what we refute. And some people started to understand this as we're not like refuting or kind of deconstructing the chair, we're actually just refuting the inherent existence of the chair. And so the style of this teaching from the commentators that we were studying was like, no, that's not enough. That's the understanding there is that if you just refute the inherent existence of the chair, it's a nice little mental exercise, and it's true, there doesn't have any inherent existence, but you have to refute the chair itself. Because otherwise you just, almost like the inherent existence is like a... they use images like a horn, like a horn on a rabbit, maybe even. So we're just saying, the rabbit doesn't have that horn called inherent existence, but it's still a rabbit. But the problem is that we're grasping the rabbit. We're grasping the chair. If you suddenly like smash the chair apart, I would be like, what are you? Smash my chair. It's been here for so long. I was so attached to it. And it's not, it was just my grasping to the inherent existence But actually, it's more subtle than this, right? So it's not that we refute this quality of things called their inherent existence. Is kind of a conceptual idea. Mm-hmm. We actually, the inherent existence of things means we think that it's a chair. Mm-hmm. It's like, we actually have to refute the chairness of the chair itself.
Mm-hmm. I totally see it that way, and it makes total sense. It seems like there's a lot more to the chair if you really look at it, but the energy that went into making the chair could be like, Do you take that into consideration? Like the artist or the craftsman that actually designed that to be a chair rather than just some inanimate object that you see? Because if you put the mm-hmm. artist or the person that made it standing next to it, it kind of makes it more...
Yeah,
relevant to... Yeah.
Yeah, so the chair depends on the artist or the craftsman. And then there's this, you know, this art movement called Dada... Right? About Dada.
Yeah.
Where it's like found art. And, you know, for a while, who were these people? The 1800s or something?
Marcel,
right? Duchamp. Yeah. Where he, like, you take a toilet, just without altering it in any way, you just put a toilet in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now in a different context. So now it's like...
It's a fountain.
So it's playing with the way our minds project. Some people say... That's stupid. That's just a toilet.
What's funny is he signed that thing as some other artist.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he didn't even claim to have been his. He signed it like some other artist to get credibility for it, which is even worse.
So then, yeah. So it's and then some people may say that's brilliant. Like no one's ever thought of that's such creative art. So it's kind of like is it a toilet or is it an art piece? So again, it depends on the context.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a brilliant kind of middle way exercise
right.
that could last for a little while until everyone started doing it. I think it was Duchamp that did the painting of a pipe and wrote "Ce n'est pas pipe" or something. Like that. This is not a pipe.
This isn't, yeah,
he wrote in French. So, also I think it's an interesting Dharma exercise. You see the picture, oh, it's a pipe. This is not a pipe. How do you, your mind starts like feeling uncomfortable at such a time.
I actually thought, first lecture, when we were talking about ta-ta,
yeah.
It occurred to me, I thought, did the expression
Dada
come from this?
Could be.
Yeah, it was the ready-mades. I think that was the movie.
Ready-mades, yeah. Ready-made art. Or found art. Yeah, maybe.
But the Dada, did it?
Yeah. I mean, whether it was intentional or just cosmic coincidence,
it's just the nature of things. Coincidence. You think about it, it seems to be
the ta movement.
Coming up now.
The movement of suchness. Yeah.
I remember a piece of Richard Serra, who's grasping rubber, just kept grasping. And after a while, you start to lose the image of it. Like the grasp becomes more than just grasping, you lose context. It's like, what is that motion? You start to kind of blurs after you see it repetitively.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again.
Yeah.
It has like a blurry, it's not just grasping anymore, it becomes something else.
Another exercise is to say like your name like 1,000 times in a row, just over and over, and it starts to sound really weird, like what? Or maybe any word would actually work, like chair, 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 chair. Huh? Like, the word starts to, when we just say it once, we just link the word immediately with the object, and it is actually a chair, we think. But if you start to say this, the word starts to become just sound, and starts to lose its meaning. It's this thing of like words creating meaning is where, which is amazing. But I mean, we're like maybe the one of the only kinds of sentient beings. The main kind of sentient beings that can do this. Mm-hmm. It's like use words to create meaning. And look at the world we create with this. And the very creative, amazing thing is the cause of our bondage, too. So, So
I won't bring this up again, but I have to tell you this. I lived with a group of artists when I was in drama school. I was living with
the Dadas,
visual artists, and somebody started this thing where all anybody said, the only sounds anybody uttered, and they used it to express everything, was da da. So it was like da da da. You know, that's how we communicated. With, you know, and I was not quite with it because I wasn't studying it then, but it was very. It was entertaining, if nothing else.
Yeah.
But it was. But we just stopped using words in the house for a period. You know, went on for a few days, a week or two, and then of course
is anything said or not?
Yeah. Baba wawa. Is there anything said or not?
Ta-da.
Ta-da.
But it can certainly be ta-ta.
That's
words. Powerful stuff.
They have meanings in different languages. Da in German means there, and da in Russian means yes.
The way I get tripped up a little bit is like suchness, I think of it as like a passive thing. You know, where we're talking about cultivation, and like, you know, there's, I mean, I kind of understand what we were just talking about, but like as far as moving in it, navigating it, you know, to be healthy, you have to exercise. You know, so is that kind of cultivation? Is that grasping? You know, am I grasping for health? Or, you know,
not necessarily.
Yeah. Or am I just being skillful?
Yeah. Because all sentient beings, whether they're eating to be healthy, wearing clothes to stay warm, exercising, have never left the nature of things. Right, so it's not like nothing can happen. That's the main point of this essay.
Maybe it can be a combination of dharma, pure dharma, but also then self-care too.
It seems to me that if we're in our natural state, we'd be healthy, and we're having to unlearn our unhealthy things, like sitting around is not a natural state, it's a learned state, whereas walking and enjoying the forest is actually more of a natural state. So we're still not cultivating when we do that. We're just not doing the learned thing. Not defiling. Yes, we're not defiling.
Well, if your goal is to be 5 miles running, or, you want to run 5 miles or whatever, then you want to be 6 miles or, skip.
It can become an attachment.
Yeah.
It can, but it can also be just actually
being not against exercise.
We do that naturally, right? I mean, like, whole, again, he's talking to people who were, like, living in the Zen monastery where it's like, Zazen's at this time, and, like, everybody comes, and, like, you do this, and you don't do that, and so, there's this whole kind of setup. And then it's like, I think that's part of the great thing about practice is that it has these two sides. And to keep us from falling into kind of an abstract nothingness, we have all these forms and precepts and stuff. And then to keep us from getting caught up in, like, trying to do something and get something and improve, then we have it just dropping off body and mind. And so they're like at the same time. But I think this integration of these, you could say, with these seemingly two sides is like a lifetime's work, you know, what that, how that actually plays out in a day-to-day, moment-to-moment way. Like I'm fully engaged and making this huge effort and I'm exhausted, but I'm going to keep going. And at the same time, this larger context of all this, it's just the nature of things.
So it could be just the nature of things without expectations.
Expectations is a big part.
Yeah,
right. Not have it, like, not having expectations. So I even have this goal. I'm going to try to get here this many miles. But if I don't, I realize I just made it up myself anyway. If I fail, then I fail. And so I got to watch that whole event.
Right.
That self-created event.
Yeah.
No path, no knowledge, no attainment, huh?
Yeah. There's nothing to attain. Bodhisattva relies on realizing the nature of things.
Daily push-ups, just don't keep count. and don't expect to get a check.
Might
just
even
do it because it's
yeah.
Like
I mean, might also even keep count, you know? Yes.
I like a sort of formula that I've used a lot that has been helpful is like, because it's not a chair, I can call it a chair. Because push-ups aren't particularly essential, I'll do some push-ups.
Okay. Okay.
Because we don't really need to come to the Zendo, I'll come to the Zendo. That, for me, that's a nice way to not get caught at either end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. Because,
yeah.
And all of this is, all of these are kind of definitions of middle way.
Yeah, it's all about the middle way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You could say dharmata is the middle way, and then particularly you have this relationship of dharmas and dharmata, that relationship is the middle way. I was looking at, this is notes from this class series with Carl Brunholzl on distinguishing dharma and dharmata. And again, dharma or phenomena is characterized by false imagination, which includes mere dualistic appearances before we even call it a chair. This is, we just open our eyes and see it, you know, in the morning, open our eyes and like, immediately, this is my room, you know, before any like, conscious thought, that's how deep our, you know, that's still dualistic mind, right?
That is dualistic
mind? I would say so.
Before?
You could say, if there's a sense that like, this is me in my room,
and I'm awake,
and we have that, we've talked about here before, I remember, like, sometimes when you're traveling, and you're moving different place every night, and you wake up in some hotel room, and you first wake up, and it sometimes takes like, you know, maybe even a full 10 seconds before, like, where am I? This is like, not familiar. There's some sense that like, it's okay, and it's not like totally surprising, but it's like, where am I again? And then the gears start turning, boom! Oh yeah, I'm in like, Bangkok or something. and then we feel, now I'm all comfortable. My dualistic mind's doing its normal thing. I know who I am and where I am. So, but for that little...
So that's when the dualistic mind kicks in for the day. I mean, it's like it jumps in.
Yeah. But even then, I would propose, if we don't even know it's Bangkok, we still have a sense that like, here's me in a bed, in a room. There's still a kind of a, like, it's a subtle duality. But my understanding of the Buddha's non-duality is like, it might appear that way, but there's really belief, like, there's not really me in a room. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the first thing the Buddha, when waking up in the morning, this is like a dream. They basically woke up from reality into a dream, like waking life. Now it's like a dream, like it looks like I have a body, there's a me with a body in a room, and you know, I mean, this is, but then it's okay if they know it's not really that way. So then, so it's the phenomena are the dualistic appearances and the labeling of the appearances, and just he makes a nice point for, I don't want to get fully into this because it's a big topic, but I know some of you have studied these three natures. This is like Yogacara teaching three natures of all phenomena. There's the other dependent nature, everything is arising dependent on everything else. There's the imputational or imagined nature where we project like a fixed concrete duality onto this coming and going, and then there's the thoroughly established nature that's suchness, or the nature of things. Mm-hmm. And so in this commentary, it's that phenomena are the mere dualistic appearances. It's like when you open your eyes in bed, and you're just like, before you have any concept of even where you are, you just at least have a sense that you're a person in a room. And you could say, that's the other dependent nature. It's just mere appearances of a world happening. And then at least this is my understanding of it, when the conceptual mind kicks in and goes, where? Oh yeah, yeah, I'm Kokyo, I'm in Bangkok, got it. That's like now really like, that's the imaginary or imputational nature, which is the labeling of the appearances. So that's like, so phenomena or dharmas, according to this Asanga text that we've talked about in the past weeks, includes this other dependent nature of the appearances of a world of duality, and then the labeling or labeling of the appearances is the imaginary nature. So dharmas includes both those two natures. Phenomena includes other dependent arising of things and the grasping of them with the imagination. And then the thoroughly established nature is dharmata. Mm-hmm. So that's how you can, these dharmas and dharmata, you can break into these three natures. So
substance beyond karma?
Yeah, well, beyond meaning like,
or you know what I mean, like not affected? Or?
In a way we could say, yeah, suchness is not affected by karma is a conceptual imputation, but you know we have to be
don't
careful
because
yeah, this is the fox story. Right? So
you'll become a fox.
So you could say
there's nothing wrong with being a fox.
And also, I think we can say that's I think okay to say suchness is beyond karma, but this koan about the fox is does a person who realizes suchness fall into karma? That's a different story because the person includes both sides. The person has never left the nature of things, but they're also living in a world. As long as they're called a person, they have these are the three natures of all phenomena. Actually, that's one of the beautiful statements of this model. It's just a model of reality, right? But all phenomena, all things have these three natures. They have the dharmata nature called the thoroughly established. They have an utter dependent nature that's the way that they appear to arise and cease. And then they have this imagined nature that like they really do exist in this separate dualistic way. And all phenomena have that. So you could say does suchness, that's kind of like your question, does suchness have any imagination in it? In a way you could say, from a certain perspective, you could say no, pure suchness has no imagination in it, but all phenomena have an imaginary nature. Well, that's right, but suchness is not a phenomena. You know, as soon as it becomes a phenomena, that's what it, phenomena means. It's imagined, actually. Yeah, yeah. And its true nature is unimaginable. and pure suchness. Pure meaning not defiled by conceptual thinking. So anyway, this Carl Brunholzer says, he's talking about, maybe somebody asks, well, what's the cultivation of the ultimate? So that's related to this discussion here. And I thought, this is nice. And this is, you know, this is a kind of like, he's a scholar practitioner, you know, in this really detailed tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, right? But I thought this is nice because, he says, cultivation of the ultimate is not taking ourselves and things so seriously. And being relaxed.
That's great.
I thought, that's like the practical way, you know. It's a very detailed, nuanced version of how things are, but then how do you actually practice with that? Don't take ourself and things so seriously. You could say even if we don't realize their suchness, we can warm up to their suchness. We can approach it by not taking them too seriously, or not seriously enough, we might also say. Right? Like not seriously enough is like, it's all empty, nothing matters, so whatever. It's like, that's it, one extreme. And then like, no, this really is a chair. And like, give me my chair back. It's mine. Just taking myself and the chair too seriously. Right?
You must have had a tree before you were...
Because it's mine. No, it's like more... it's mine, okay? Yeah. And then we could say, not taking things so seriously, we start to see how open to how a Buddha relates to things is like, they're really, it's like a dream. Then you don't take it that seriously if you know it's a dream. And then you could say, that's approaching the realization of it, but then also you could say the reverse, like the effect of realization of it would be also that we don't take it so seriously. And also you could say, in training with this, we could say, I like to look at it this way. It's like when I'm taking things too seriously, that's like a sort of like reminder to me that like I've lost the view of reality. Mm-hmm. I've lost the view of suchness. No, I really have to work this one out. It's like often I don't recognize it at that time, but if I afterwards or even at the time, well, I'm like really like getting obsessed with this or something, mm-hmm. then it's like I'm like basically like. I'm in delusion anyway, but now I'm like really reifying delusion, and I'm really caught by it. And therefore, like, where's Matsu? And where's the Zahafu? And then, not taking ourselves and things so seriously. It gives us a sense of what nirvana is like. Nice. Not saying just, if we're just relaxed and not taking things too seriously, it's not necessarily that that is nirvana, but it gives us some sense of maybe something like not making a big thing of anything. And then maybe again somebody asks, well, if Buddhas don't have this conceptual consciousness, how do they experience phenomena? And he said, they don't.
They don't experience it, but what do they do?
They experience dharmata instead of dharma.
Through phenomena, yeah.
Through phenomena, yeah. And part of the nuance in the root text says that dharma, phenomena and the nature of phenomena, dharmas and dharmata, are not the same. But also they're not separate. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
So dharmas always come along. The appearance of things always comes along with the reality of things. So, you know. So again, we'll continue in this way. But after this quote of Matsu, Dogen says, the dharma nature spoken of by Matsu is dharma nature speaking of dharma nature. Or... is dharma nature spoken of by dharma nature? So he's basically, this is Dogen, you know, playing with sentence structure and stuff here. He's basically reminding us of what he's already said, is that everybody and everything is already in dharma nature. Therefore, this quote of Matsu is actually dharma nature itself, speaking of dharma nature. And Matsu is dharma nature. The words in his mouth are dharma nature, and so on. It practices together with Matsu. It practices together with dharma nature. Or another translation, a little different. It, meaning dharma nature. It learns from the same source as Matsu. It is a fellow student of dharma nature. Instead of it practices together with Matsu and practices together with dharma nature. I think it's maybe the word practice and learn. Yeah, I think it's because it's like study. Study. So it could be like practicing the way, studying the way, but also means learning. Mm-hmm. So So Dharma nature learns from the same source as Matsu, and Dharma nature is a fellow student with Matsu of Dharma nature. Mm-hmm. It just helps open our minds to like how dynamic this all works is.
How inclusive it is.
How inclusive it is. I hear this, so how should I not speak of it? Or another translation is, since there is hearing of it, how could there not be speaking of it? And I just thought of some Zen story of something like, sometimes it said, you know, just don't try to learn a whole bunch of stuff in order to like teach people. Just try to realize suchness, and then just expression will just naturally pour forth. And I think there was some Zen ancestor or something who like never spoke for like 30 years or something, and then like then he had some realization, and then he couldn't stop talking. Since there's hearing of this Dharma nature, how could there not be speaking of it? In other words, there's a natural impulse to just express such a Dharma nature. Dharma nature rides on Matsu. And in parentheses, Matsu means horse ancestor. So it's just playing with the way you ride on a horse.
Yeah.
Dharma nature rides on the horse ancestor. And we might also say that the horse ancestor Matsu rides on Dharma nature. And similarly, a person takes a meal and a meal takes a person. So this is like this interdependent relationship of everything that's going on in this Dharma nature world. It's like we're eating the food, but actually the food's like feeding us, you might say.
Is that being actualized by the myriad things?
Yeah.
Is that the same?
Yeah. To be actualized by the myriad things
would be another way to say, I mean, a person takes a meal.
And when I read those lines, I thought of, you are not it. Mm-hmm. It actually is you.
Sure.
Or in truth, it is you.
Yeah.
Like, and we could apply that to Dharma nature, thinking like, yeah, I'm in Dharma nature all the time, and like, I, Kokyo, actually am Dharma nature. Mm-hmm. And then Dungshan in the Jiwamira Samadhi says, just to turn it a little bit, he says, actually, you're not it. He's talking about the jewel mirror samadhi, which I propose is the same as the Dharma nature samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
You are not the jewel mirror samadhi. It, in truth, is you.
Mm-hmm. You are what you eat.
You are what you eat.
You
are what you eat.
Yes.
Or what you eat. What you eat is you. Or,
don't take me seriously.
But yeah, you are what you eat is a kind of statement of dependent arising, actually, right?
Yeah.
In itself, yeah.
And the food speaks.
Once being Dharma nature, you don't leave Dharma nature samadhi, or ever since Dharma nature, and you know, Dharma nature is beginningless, but. Ever since beginningless Dharma nature, you don't leave Dharma nature samadhi, or another translation is it doesn't leave. You know, in Chinese and Japanese often there's no pronouns.
Yeah.
It doesn't leave. Dharma nature samadhi doesn't leave, or Dharma nature doesn't leave Dharma nature samadhi. You or it don't leave Dharma nature before being Dharma nature. You don't leave Dharma nature after being Dharma nature.
Mm.
Which there is no before and after to escape from Dharma nature. Dharma nature, together with immeasurable eons, is Dharma nature's samadhi. Dharma nature is called immeasurable eons. So it's not like, again, not like there's all these immeasurable eons that are arising and ceasing in Dharma nature. Those eons of time are Dharma nature. We might say actually time is Dharma nature. And being is Dharma nature. Thus, just this right now is Dharma nature. Or another translation is, the here of the immediate present is Dharma nature. That's what I was thinking of when John said, just being totally present. So this is the part he's bringing out. The here and now is where it's at. Dharma nature. It can't be some abstract future event.
Because as soon as we allow ourselves, as soon as we go off balance, we cease to be in the moment. Or we lean to the past, we lean to the future.
You could say we don't really cease to be in the moment, but we start imagining the imputational nature creates a belief that we're actually not in the present. And that's like somewhat painful. Even if it's like a fantasy of this great thing that's going to happen in the future, or the fondest memory of the past, we like to do that. We like to create it. We think, we feel like it would be more interesting and enjoyable than the present. But I think from a practice point of view, it's like when we're doing that, it's really not as enjoyable. Yeah. It's hard to recognize that at the time, and like the present could seem totally boring, like sashimi.
But the moment
is good
we recognize we're back in the moment.
If you recognize that the projection is a projection,
is it right?
Yeah, yeah, you could say if you recognize that the imputational nature of things is merely imputation, then it kind of like that imputational nature almost like sinks in back into the other dependent nature.
I remember saying, asking a question with my teacher in Australia and saying, I'm always in the past and I'm always in the future, and she just looked at me, she said, how do you do that? It was so beautiful. I was in front of a really big crowd. And I was like, I didn't know what to do.
It's easy.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Quite well taken.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's a reminder that just this right now is Dharma nature. And again, we know all sentient beings have never left it, even when they're thinking of the past and future. But it's like when we start believing that the past and future, that we really can go there, then it's not that we've left Dharma nature, but we're just like not fully celebrating the Dharma nature of the present.
It's obscured.
It's obscured, yeah. Mm-hmm. Dharma nature is just this right now. Wearing a robe and eating a meal is Dharma nature samadhi, wearing a robe and having a meal. And you know, I don't know if he's making much difference between Dharma nature and Dharma nature samadhi. He's, you know, sometimes he throws that samadhi on the end, and maybe no real difference. Maybe it just reads more poetically to sometimes use it and sometimes not. But maybe it's that samadhi is emphasizing more like the experience,
or the moment on the pillow. I mean, the actual about.
I don't think it means like formal zazen on the cushion, because
the moment. But.
The moment.
A moment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Absorption in the nature of things is one translation of Dharma nature, samadhi. We could say, and we talked about in one of the past classes about how this term samadhi often refers to, like, you know, the formal cultivation of upright sitting on the cushion, right? Mm-hmm. The practice of meditative concentration. But also, samadhi has this meaning of just, you know, one-pointedness of mind and object, and it's a universal quality of all experience, according to Abhidharma teachings. Every moment of experience has samadhi is one of its qualities. So it's kind of a different meaning of samadhi.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness. Yeah, maybe like awareness. Yeah, I mean, we could look into this more. Why Abhidharma texts, you know, pre-Mahayana, talk about that as one of these five factors of every conscious experience. Mm-hmm. We could might also say there's like a one-pointedness. Even if we're distracted and we're thinking of a lot of things, still the mind and its objects are like connected.
Yeah.
Even if it's scattered, it's still, we're still, that we, it's called, that's a certain kind of samadhi. Even totally distracted.
Yeah.
So, so it may be playing with that, this sort of double meaning of samadhi here. Dharma nature that is a robe or clothing is actualized. And actualized is genjo, which is one of Dogen's favorite terms, as in genjo koan. But he uses throughout the Shobogenzo over and over again genjo. And I don't think it was like a particularly super common expression in his time. I think he's just part of Dogen's style is really talking about how suchness is actualized or expressed in the world, or manifested or actualized. Jean talked about the word genjo a couple weeks ago on a Wednesday night as that quality of manifest, something that's manifest that wasn't previously hidden, I think is how Jean was talking about.
Is the character there the same as the character used and actualized by a million things?
When actualized by myriad things. Carry yourself forward to experience the myriad things.
Is it the same actualization?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. When actualized, I think it might be in that case, yeah. When Dogen says to carry yourself forward and experience myriad things, that's different. But when actualized by myriad things, yeah, that might be. At least one, if not both Gan and Joe, at least one.
One.
I think so. Not positive. So Dharma nature, that is a robe, is actualized. But again, this is a sentence that, way Chinese goes, could be translated various ways. So it's like, A, which is clothing, Hosho, Dharma nature, Genjo. So, clothing, Dharma nature, actualized, you know, literally. But another translation is, it is the manifestation of the Dharma nature of clothing. Mm-hmm. Or another translation is, clothing is the manifestation of Dharma nature. Mm-hmm. So, they all are true.
I mean, basically, Dharma nature, robe, actualized, that's what's important, and the translators keep trying to link them into the past. But it's really the kind of coexistent arising experience.
And I think the big point here, and usually with Genjo, is we're talking about some kind of like formless, inexpressible, ultimate truth that in the Buddhist tradition is just, I mean, like Ken said, passive, or it might be like, it's the way things are, but it's just vast emptiness, like space. And yet it is manifested, or it's actualized. So,
coexistent, co-arising.
Coexistent, co-arising.
At the same time.
Yeah. Yeah, Dharma and Dharmata are coexistent, co-arising. And so Dharmata, you know, is traditionally is this ineffable emptiness side of things. But this Dharma, but clothing is the manifestation or actualization of Dharma nature. And we're just talking about the most ordinary thing. Food and clothing are manifestations of this empty suchness.
It just seems that this is saying what is simply put elsewhere by Dogen as being actualized by myriad things.
I think that's what he's saying. I think he's just saying it in a different way, which he does all the time.
Yeah.
That's what I
he wrote the whole Shobogenzo about that point.
Right.
He's always saying the same thing.
Yeah. In a way, he's always saying the same thing.
A million different ways,
but they're slightly different. And they maybe point us, or they like, you know, shake us out of a little something. And we've heard the Gendur Koan so many times, maybe, that it's like,
but for me right now, it's like making more sense all of a sudden. That's what we've been saying all along.
There you go, point made.
And again, the relationship of these two sides is not just Dogen, but this is all these Zen poems, the merging of difference and unity is about this, which I hear also as like a commentary in a way, or a new expression of the Heart Sutra. Form itself is emptiness. Mm-hmm. Emptiness itself is or manifests Genjo as form. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, nothing new is ever being said.
What I like about this paragraph, just going on to the other side too, for me what it feels like it's helping me with is not to skip over and fail to notice what might be Dharma nature. Like, not only is it
ordinary,
the wearing of
the robe,
it's not just the eating, it's the meal.
Yeah.
But
it's a thing.
Not to habitually skip over something and fail to recognize its suchness. So that's, you know, as I read through that, it's like, it's not just wearing the robe and eating the meal, it's the robe and the meal. And, you know, I'm sure we could think of something else.
Yeah, it's activities and things.
Yeah.
Both, which are quite different. We think of them quite differently.
Forget some of them.
Yeah. Dharma nature is a meal that's actualized. Dharma nature no other than eating is actualized. Dharma nature no other than wearing is actualized. Without wearing a robe and eating a meal, without exchanging words, and without the activities of the six sense roots and all activities, there is no Dharma nature samadhi, and there is no entering Dharma nature.
So it comes back to negate samadhi here. I mean, or reverse it.
Well, without, if there were no doing anything. In other words, I think without wearing a robe and eating a meal means any activity.
Yeah.
Without some form. Without some activity, there's no Dharma nature samadhi, right?
So that's the interdependent
form. Yeah, without form, there is no emptiness in this case. Without.
In a way, like how beautiful that is to appreciate the wearing of a robe and eating of a meal.
Yeah. And really, like, remember that, in our daily life, it might be like, I just like. Spending all this time like cooking and eating this meal before I go on to the next thing. That's why like our fast food culture is built on this idea. It's like eating a meal is just something that you try to get over with to get onto your real life. And same with putting on clothes. There's a nice thing about like the priest clothing is because there's like all these layers and it's like totally inconvenient. Like who designed this? Like there's Chinese robes where you just like more like this kind of robe where you just put it on over your pants and it's very easy, but like the usual priest thing is you have to like take off all your other clothes, your work clothes, and you put on all these other layers. And sometimes like in the monastery you have to like change into work clothes and out of work clothes like several times a day, like very quickly. And it's like why don't we redesign this? And like, well, maybe it's to appreciate that without wearing a robe or some kind of clothing, that there's no Dharma nature. In other words, that Dharma nature is this activity of putting them on and taking them off, and putting them on and taking them off. And putting them off. Well, can't we just go to Zazen? No. This is Zazen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or one of the few teachings I remember from when I first met our late Abbess Catherine Thanis at Tassajara, like 25 years ago or something. The year she left being Tanto with Tassajara to come to Santa Cruz was the year I arrived there. So she was like the first Dharma teacher I met, really. And I don't remember that much. It was a long time ago, but I remember little snippets and one thing. And it wasn't like in a Dharma talk, it was like at the lunch table.
Yeah.
But it was some conversation. I remember she was talking about this this form that Dogen talks about, like before Zazen, you like rock your body right and left and settle into a steady, immovable sitting position, says in the Fukan Sazengi. So Soto Zen still carries on. If you're sitting cross-legged, I think if you're kneeling or maybe wouldn't make so much sense. I think it's a little bit like you're stretching. It's a little bit stretch. But and then you kind of like find this balance place and then you're like, start sitting. And Catherine's teaching was something like, when you're doing this rocking, if you're doing this, it's like, Zazen's already started. This is not like getting ready for Zazen. Yes. This is like part of Zazen. And some, she would do that rocking thing, I remember. Oh, and she'd do it like really, really slowly, as I recall. Yeah, it was like,
we're all thinking,
yeah, like start talking. Are you going to say something? We can't even talk. Without rocking back and forth, there is no Dharma nature. Without wearing a robe, eating a meal, without exchanging words, without the activities of the six sense fruits and all activities, that's all from the quote of Matsu. There is no Dharma nature, samadhi. There's no entering Dharma nature. The actualized expression of just now was handed down from Buddha to Buddha through Shakyamuni Buddha. So it's a little interesting Japanese thing that the word expression here is do, and do means to speak or express. I know Kathy was studying for a while. Do Toku is a name of one of Dogen's fascicles. And Do Toku means expression, but just Do by itself means expression. But it's the same character, Dao.
Wow.
It means the way.
Yeah.
So it's completely different meaning.
Yeah.
And like why that's the same character. I mean, in English we have words like that too, right?
Mm-hmm.
But really quite a different meaning. But so therefore, it's open to interpretation. And so cause here translated as the actualized expression, but another translation is the actualized way.
Well, yeah, so that would be Genjo Do.
Yeah, it's Genjo Do. Yeah, the Genjo Do, the actualized way or path, one person even says, which is quite different than expression, right? And I think they do have a different meaning, but they're both true, you could say. The actualized path or way of just now was handed down from Buddha to Buddha, and also the actualized expression of just now and the way to express just now through the Shobogenzo and so on was handed down from Buddha to Buddha through Shakyamuni Buddha. It was authentically transmitted from ancestor to ancestor through Matsu. It has been authentically handed down from Buddha to Buddha, from ancestor to ancestor, by means of Dharma nature samadhi. So you could say, the way of practicing suchness, and this transmission from ancestor to ancestor that's so important for, in Dogen's teaching, happens by this Dharma nature, Samadhi, by means of, sponsored by the Dharma nature, Samadhi. Buddhas and ancestors enliven Dharma nature without the need to enter it. That's one of my favorite sentences here. Because it's like, how do you express what you do if you're already in Dharma nature? So earlier, you know, I said celebrate or, you know, appreciate, but I'm always looking for words to, you're not trying to attain it or get it. So this word enliven.
Great.
Yeah. And the word that in Chinese, it's even better because it's the first character, is katsu, means like to enliven or to revive or to restore to life. Like almost like somebody's maybe passed out and you kind of wake them up or something. Like to revive them or to freshen. Also like, say like a flower when you, Liz is very good about changing the water in the flower vases.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of enlivens them. Mm-hmm. If you just change the water, it freshens them. Mm-hmm. And it revives them. Katsu. And it has the radical for water in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then next character is patsu.
Patsu?
Yes.
Ooh.
And there's two patsus in a row. So, and you abbreviate it by saying, kapatsu patsu. Kapatsu patsu.
No wonder you like it.
And the second patsu is like a fresh appearance, but it also, and it has the radical for fish, and it's apparently like a really obscure character. It was hard to find this, but it's something like a leaping fish.
Oh,
it's like
patsu?
A patsu. Yeah. And it's also an onomatopoeia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's, so a double a fish jumping patsu patsu as it splashes out of the water. So I think all that's in there.
Wow.
And Dogen uses it like a couple other places in the Shobogenzo.
And is it always translated as
in Lyman? In Kaz's Shobogenzo, in the glossary in the back, it says enliven. I think it says enliven, and it says kapatsu patsu. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't say that. I think somewhere else where Dogen uses this, I recall in the past, it's something like the lively activity of a darting fish. Somebody actually translated it like that. So Buddhas and ancestors, kapatsu patsu, Dharma nature, without the need to enter it. They have no need to enter it because they're already in it. But they enliven
it. They're actually in and out of it.
Yeah. Well, they don't even really leave it. But maybe you could say, yeah, the activity of splashing is like dancing with the border, the edge of Dharma nature. Almost like, can we leave it? No, we'll just drown immediately if we do. If the fish leaves the water, it will die at once.
Yeah.
If the bird leaves the air, it will die at once.
Mm-hmm.
But they enliven, so you could say, if we're already complete, then what's practice? It's just enlivening the completeness, freshening it, reviving, vitalizing it, leaping about in it. Even though Dharma teachers of letters or scholars speak of Dharma nature, it's not the Dharma nature spoken of by Matsu. A classic Zen thing is a little bit of, they like to diss the pure academics who are just like, Dharma nature's like this, and then it's got these qualities, and meanwhile they're like, give me my chair!
Uh-oh. Yes, sir.
It's like Zen was this new way of expressing, free of all these complicated categories. And, you know, sometimes it's a time to express complicated qualities and lists, and so we'll have a class on Nagarjuna later this year.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and we'll hope that Dogen won't roll over in his grave. Dogen loved Nagarjuna, but he spoke in a different way. So this Dharma nature spoken of by these scholars of letters is not the Dharma nature spoken of by Matsu. The statement that sentient beings who have not come out of Dharma nature can never be Dharma nature may happen to have a point. I think it's the statement that sentient beings who don't come out of Dharma nature can never be Dharma nature themselves may happen to have a point. Now, I'm not sure exactly what this is, but I can imagine it's maybe like particularly from the scholar point of view, when we're distinguishing Dharma and Dharmata, we could say, well, sentient beings are in the category of phenomena. When we're talking about sentient beings, that's the dualistic appearances of you and I, and that's like not the same as Dharma nature. Sentient beings, when they realize Buddhahood, they're no longer sentient beings. They're now they're Buddhas, and they're now coursing in Dharma nature samadhi. So that's the way the scholars might talk, is that sentient beings like you and I actually are not Dharma nature. If we hear it like that, then Dogen says that statement may have a good point. Mm-hmm. Yet such a statement is three or four more pieces of Dharma nature, mm-hmm. or three or four more layers of Dharma nature. So you could say it doesn't even matter what the point is. Any kind of like point of the scholars in expounding Dharma, you know, whether it's convoluted or clear or whatever, each expression is itself just more and more layers of Dharma nature. So therefore, we have to be careful not to get trapped by the words. Talks and activities to deny Dharma nature, like that, you know, might be like the talk of like, well, sentient beings are not truly Dharma nature. Sentient beings are not Buddhas. That would like derail the whole project of Buddha Dharma, mm-hmm. somebody might say. That would be like talk that denies Dharma nature. But that talk and activity that denies Dharma nature is also Dharma nature. Or another translation is, to speak, function, and act as if it were not Dharma nature must also be Dharma nature. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and I think statements like that are like Dogen likes to inject into a lot of his writings, and I take that as a nice instruction too. As times when we're like, we maybe like really fail with our vows or something, or like I'm really like caught up in like delusion right now, and I kind of have recognized it too, but like, and I can't get out of it. I'm like really caught, and like, this is a time I definitively declare. I like to do this sometimes. I mean, I hate to do it, but I do it. I declare I am like totally deluded, like deluded beyond deluded, and there's like Buddhahood is like a million miles away, you know. And like at such a time, I think that's, you might feel like that sometimes. That
that's Dharma nature.
Yeah,
Dharma nature.
That to speak and act as if it were not Dharma nature must be Dharma nature. Mm-hmm. Almost like, and sometimes we kind of wallow in it. Like, I'm so far outside it. Like, I don't even care. It's so hopeless that like, forget about it. What about practice now? Forget about practice. Bunch of garbage. I don't believe any of it. You know? You ever get into those spaces?
Oh.
and then we like slowly, crawl back out, or we it wears off, basically, and we're like, oh, I really was in Dharma nature at that time. But I really did not believe it, and no one would have been able to convince me at that time. But that's a nice statement. To speak and act and almost like vow and like declare to the universe that you are not in Dharma nature. Must be Dharma nature. Days and months in immeasurable eons are the passage of Dharma nature. Present and future are also like this. Thinking that one is far from Dharma nature, making the scale or the limit of one's body and mind as the scale or limit of this body and mind, this thinking is Dharma nature. Both thinking and not thinking are Dharma nature. Those who think that water does not flow or trees do not grow and decay in what is called Dharma nature are people outside the way. In other words, so obviously thinking and not thinking are both Dharma nature, which is kind of like think of not thinking, and both of these are included in non-thinking. And to think that water doesn't flow and trees don't decay, these are like activities. These are like coming and going in the world of coming and going. So to think that coming and going and arising and ceasing doesn't happen in Dharma nature is a thought of people outside the way. Even though we might say that thought itself is Dharma nature. But we might say to believe that that thought is true is like temporarily or for a long time being outside the way. So, enough for now. Thanks. I'll have one more and we can finish it out. And may all beings who've never left Dharma nature for innumerable eons, eating, wearing clothes, and talking and going about their days, fully freshen, enliven, kapatsu-patsu this Dharma nature for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.